You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. In just a moment, we're going to be talking to author Salvatore Scibona. And we don't do a lot of fiction on this show. We probably should do a little more. But this novel came across my desk, and it is just fabulous. So we will be hearing more about it in just a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential, offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Salvatore Scibona. He's director of the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library, and he's author of the new novel, The Volunteer. He will be speaking about his book on Wednesday, March 27th at 7:30 at Peterson Student Center at St. John's College here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a really beautifully written book that starts with the story of a boy whose American father is estranged from his Latvian mother. The mother no longer wants to take care of him. The father meets the boy at an airport in Hamburg, Germany, and then abandons him there and goes home to New Mexico. Sort of a shocking beginning of the book. That story goes back in time, takes us to a farm in rural Iowa, and a couple that really should have been too old to have children, but they have one whose nickname is Volley for volunteer, which made me think about a plant that you didn't plant, but it still comes up. Then he volunteers to go to Vietnam. He's deployed. He's imprisoned. He eventually comes back and takes on a new name and identity, cuts all ties to the past. I don't want to give away the whole story because people might read the book, but what is the origin of this story? How did it come to you?
Thank you for that summary. That was exactly what I could have really used several years ago as a way of clarifying to myself all the central things that are going on. There's very little in the book that comes from life, except for the first two pages or so. I was in Latvia trying to write this book and being stuck in many ways. And I went to visit Hamburg to visit my German publisher there, the German publisher of my first book. And on the way home, I was in an airport waiting in line at the check-in counter because I had 7 euros in my pocket and I wanted to see how much a martini costs on that plane, because it bothers me to waste money that way. And at the time, Latvia was still using the lat. Anyway, as I was waiting in line, there was a child who was about 5 years old. His mother and a flight attendant were talking to him. He was crying in this really penetrating way that also seemed really self-controlled. I couldn't figure out what he was upset about. And then the mother went and sat down in the chairs with the rest of the passengers, and I realized she wasn't the mother at all. When I got to the counter, eventually, I asked the guy at the counter how much it cost to buy a martini on this plane, and he said, "I don't know. I don't work for this airline. Air Baltic has only one flight out of this airport." And I said, "Who do you work for?" He said, "I work for the airport." And I said, "Oh, do you know what that kid was crying about?" Because by this point, the kid had cried for a really long time and then had gone away. At that moment, I saw him coming around the corner with that same flight attendant. He was leading her, pointing this way and that way. And evidently, he had been crying straight for about a half an hour. And the guy behind the counter said, "Nobody can figure out what language he's speaking."
Oh, my goodness.
And that was when I turned and looked around and realized that everybody sitting and waiting for the flight had just been transfixed and horrified by this. And everybody had heard what had happened. And it seemed pretty clear that someone had abandoned this kid in the airport. Everywhere you went in the airport, there were announcements blaring. "There is a child at this gate. Please come to this gate. This is where the child is," in all these different languages. And it didn't seem to matter. So I tried Italian and French on him and Spanish to see if he would talk to me. He didn't seem to understand me either. And as I walked him to the edge of the security zone with a woman who worked for the airline, she opened the door. They went through the door closed, and I never saw him again.
And so you don't know where the kid was from or what the real story was.
Not a clue, nothing.
Very interesting. But that stayed with you.
Yeah, it was, well, it was, I bet you a dollar that everybody who saw it is haunted by it to this day. It was primal as a dream. It was the primal dream in a way, you know, the first dream that you could know of that your parents would abandon you. So the book is really my way of trying to understand how that boy got to that spot, and that required going back about 60 years in time to the people who are responsible for parenting the man who is responsible for parenting the little boy.
Right.
It takes several generations to get to a crime like that.
Which is really such an important thing to think about, which is that, I mean, I was listening to a news program today about crime, and it was on the BBC, and the interviewer, the journalist, said something about, and those who indulge in acts of criminal behavior. And I was thinking, indulge? You know, these people are so often so traumatized, and that trauma is generational and goes back, Lord only knows how far.
Yeah, I found, I mean, I think there is a serious element in this book of behavior and emotion being passed from one generation to the next. But it was also very important to me that, like, I'm not an expert in psychopathology, and I haven't tried to do that. I've tried to inhabit as best as I could the individual people involved in the story and just follow the course of their decisions. You know, why did this person do this thing? Why does this person do this thing? Why does this person do this thing? In the case of the man who's left the kid in the airport, yeah, it certainly isn't an indulgence, but he's also on the hook. You know, he's not, everybody in the book in some way makes mistakes, and they all have different consciousnesses of how responsible they are for what they've done. And also, they have different levels of responsibility and feelings of responsibility, even for acts of a kind of heroism, you know? Some people are really as reluctant to take credit for being brave as they are to take responsibility for their mistakes.
Very interesting. Now, the kind of first part of the, or a lot of the first part of the book takes place in Vietnam, and Volley, the main character, one of the main characters, is a prisoner for a while, and it's a really kind of interesting, murky situation because he is in Cambodia, but Congress has already disallowed U.S. involvement in Cambodia. So he is there illegally, and they kind of have to make him disappear. Because he's the only survivor of that particular set of actions. You were born really after the Vietnam War, or at the very, very end. What is the role of Vietnam? Like, you know, it's so incredibly vivid. What is Vietnam and your own personal connection to that war?
Yeah, I was born within a couple of months of the famous helicopter taking off from the top of the embassy. All of my experience of that war is in retrospect. And that makes me, you know, a couple of steps removed from a lot of people in American culture. There are obviously people who were there. Then there were people who were in the military who were not there. And then there were people who were drafted and did everything that they could not to go. There were people with loved ones who were involved. There were, of course, the Vietnamese in the North and the South. There were the Viet Cong. There were the NVA. There was the Army of South Vietnam. And then there are the rest of us afterward who know about this only not through news stories, but through books and effectively retrospectives. America's been trying to make sense of what happened there for a long time. And my father was a Marine in Vietnam. He volunteered to go in 1967. and he served two tiers of duty there and lived to tell the tale, although he didn't tell me very much about his experience at all until I was an adult, which I think is pretty common, not only not talking to children about such things, but among Vietnam veterans, I think there's, as we all know, it was not a culture that welcomed a lot of public conversation from veterans about their experiences there, and that has changed. So yeah, I think the war in Vietnam for me is a lot of things. I mean, here's an example of a kind of strange historical knowledge that we have. As long as I have been alive, human beings have walked on the moon. So it's not strange to me that human beings have walked on the moon. I can sort of wrap my mind around the glamour of what that must have been like, the amazement that people felt. But it's never going to be surprising to me. But for the people who were adults in 1969 and saw that happen, I can't imagine, but I can only imagine how it must have felt to be witnessing for the first time in the history of the human race something like that happening. Well, up until the Vietnam War, America had never lost a war. And the idea of sending troops overseas to fight on behalf of the United States, as conflicted and difficult and brutal as it was certainly for previous generations, it was never attended by losing and everything that comes with losing or having failed at your objective really dramatically. But when I was growing up, that was more or less the narrative of the United States, that the most recent war we had fought was the first one that we had lost. And the analysis of what caused that to happen was really all around me.
At home, because your father had been there?
No, we didn't talk about it in that way. Certainly, my father didn't consider the war lost. We never talked about it, really. The more important thing that we talked about at home very consistently was that whatever it was I had learned in school was wrong. That there was really fundamentally no way that what I had digested from history books could possibly account for what he had seen and heard with his own eyes. And my grandfather, who was also a Marine in the Second World War in the South Pacific, said almost the same thing. They would sort of, pat me on the head and ruefully laugh whenever I presumed to have anything to say on the subject of either one of these wars, even though, I had read more about what had happened from a larger strategic, point of view, and tried to my understanding of it was from books that were trying to put those wars in the context of history. And their understanding was, on this particular day, I drove from this particular base past this particular tree, and the truck in front of me blew up.
Right.
I think it was sort of made very clear to me that their firsthand experience was actual in a way that nothing I was later going to be able to read about could approach. And that, of course, kind of settled into my mind as an important, later on when I started writing fiction, it's probably one of the reasons that what's called realist fiction, whether that's the appropriate word or not, has been so powerful for me, because the fiction writer's remit really is to try to overcome that barrier and to give the reader something as close as possible to firsthand experience.
Yeah. Well, what you're saying makes me think about two things. One is that, to me, the book, in a lot of ways, was about power and the mechanisms of power as they play out in the lives of ordinary people whom power doesn't even really care about, but who were necessary to implement their plans. And then what it means to be one of those people, like, the people in the book, and also as you're talking about your father and grandfather, what it means to have an identity within that when on some level you are being used in ways that you don't understand. And the other thing that it makes me think about is, and this kept on coming up for me as I was reading about the difference between the job of a fiction writer and the job of a historian, which is the historian takes the facts as best as we can lay them out, tries to make sense of them, interprets the places where there might be kind of gaps or differences of interpretation, but he's fundamentally writing in his or her own voice. Whereas when you're writing fiction, you still have to do all that and deeply understand what it's like to be inside the bodies of the people who are living it out.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, a funny thing about this is that in the galleys of this book, as just as the pages fell, the end of the text was on the left-hand page, which normally means that the acknowledgments are immediate on the immediately right-hand following page. And I just had to beg and plead to get that moved, because specifically of what you say about the historian speaking in her own voice. And I really believe that a novel is not in the voice of the author. The novel is in the voice of the narrator. And I wanted there to be, I wanted the reader to have a white page.
Yeah.
To separate the moment where the, you know, from the narrator speaking to me speaking. If I had my way, really, I would find some way of not speaking at all, because I don't want to be there. But yeah, the historian has an obligation, a kind of personal responsibility to maybe the historian has a personal responsibility to speak in her own voice. And a fiction writer in some way, at least the kind of fiction that I'm talking about, the novelist has a responsibility not to do that, in order to speak more closely, not just in the voice of the characters or from the voice of the characters, but somehow in the voice of the book. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like the narrator is, you know, the narrator of a free and direct style novelist is up in the air and then is coming down and is borrowing a little bit from the language or the mind of one character. And then without even warning you, jumping into the mind of another character, and then sometimes writing from the point of view of the mountainside, and that narrator is all over the place. And somehow what it all adds up to is that the narrator or the narrative is a kind of character itself. So there's no place for the author to intercede. At least that's what I want. I mean, I don't want to be there.
Very interesting. So what's the process like of being engaged in that as you're actually writing?
Well, I think free and direct style, as we've been talking about it, is totally legible, and it's a great technology that most of us don't even know we know how to use. We associate it with 19th century novelists like Chekhov and George Eliot, but it's alive and well, and people use it all the time. What it's like is immensely freeing. You are not subject to the limits of your own knowledge. You are able to speak with authority about things that you just learned as though they were the facts you've always had. You are not confined to the box of your own personality. This a great thing that I find in writing fiction, just a huge joy, is that, you know, I have a personality like anybody else and limitations, emotional limitations that make it impossible for me to extend certain kinds of empathy, for example, myself. But I can write a character who can, and that allows me the vicarious experience of that kind of an emotional ability. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could really, for example, I mean, I think the character of Ollie Frayd is much tougher than I am. He can endure physical pain better than I can. And if you get close enough to a character over time in writing a book, it's as though you have that ability. You feel you partake in that ability while you're writing from that character's voice. And you don't do that in order just, you know, I'm not trying to be a pedagogue about it. Like I wouldn't try to learn from him how to, you know, be a tougher dude. But the end result is just this immense freedom from the cage of self.
Right. I often imagine that really good actors have that same kind of freedom that you're talking about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. The one thing that the actor doesn't get to do that the novelist gets to do is not be there, in the sense that the novelist can also occupy the voice of the narrator, who's not even a person showing up. You know, the actor always has to be one of the people
right
in the story, and the narrator can be effaced.
Well, this is so interesting because, I mean, okay, the book starts with a couple of lines from Emily Dickinson, "I'm nobody, who are you? Are you nobody too?"
Right.
And you're talking about disappearance and that kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, destruction or disillusion or vanishing of self or of ego,
mm-hmm.
plays out in the book in a number of ways. And I mean, one of those ways has to do, and I'm just coming back to this theme of power and what mechanisms far beyond the control of individuals, how they affect the lives of those individuals and what they do to their identities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a lot of reversals in the story. And one of the reversals, I think, is this is the kind of stuff that I shouldn't indulge in because it's sort of me saying what I think is what it means. And I've sort of had my last say about what it means. But I think that what Vali experiences in the war in Vietnam is the force of a terrifyingly large, powerful institution, the United States military, that is able to throw him around with perfect impunity. And that is not, you know, it's certainly a dramatic, being in the military is certainly a dramatic example of that, but it's not radically different from the kinds of impositions of power that happen from economic forces, from global capitalism, for example.
Right.
But the reversal that happens in the book in some way, I think, although Vali doesn't think about it in structural political terms like this, is that he kind of turns the tables on that apparatus. This system that wants to squash him and treat him as not an individual self, but just part of a mass, he effectively goes to that institution and says, "Sign me up. Take away my name. Take away my individuality, myself. I don't want to," because his longtime dream and the sort of dream that the book is largely about is the possibility of being alive as an animal, thinking, living presence that's human in the world without having to have an I, without having to be somebody. As Emily Dickinson later says in that poem, "How dreary to be somebody." His hope really is to be able to have that kind of, to extend that kind of transcendent experience that I think many of us have had at certain moments of our experience of the natural world, for example, or of love, sometimes of music. He certainly has it of music.
Yeah.
It's the experience of being awake and alive and not having a self that mediates between your being and the world outside of you.
The book contains an extraordinary wealth of original detail, and it's descriptive in ways that bespeak either an immense amount of research or a photographic level of observation, or both. I did not detect a single false note in the whole book, and I'm quite a critical reader. Tell us about this process of getting the details right. It must have taken a lot of time and a lot of patience.
Well, that's very kind of you. I think the early drafts of my first book were really probably heavily influenced by being a student at St. John's College in Santa Fe and reading philosophy. I'm sure that when I started writing fiction, I believed much more in explicit ideas on the page, and I didn't believe enough in physical life on the page. And as I revised that first book, the ideas were more and more submerged beneath physical detail. And then eventually I started having a goal of, you know, what if you could make a book that was completely physical detail? Not absent ideas, but, you know, the ideas are sort of the understructure and the physical details are the shape of them. But that dance is very important to me, and it's immense. It's just a great joy to write that way. It's akin to William Carlos Williams's idea from that poem, "No ideas but in things."
Right.
In other words, it's possible to have serious philosophical, metaphysical, theological, emotional conversation and do it in terms of stuff, do it in terms of drama and detail. We've all had this experience. You know, you see a painting and the painting just is a blow to your heart and blows up your mind at the same time. And yet it's only colors. Ultimately, it's just stimulation to the eye. The arrangement of the colors, the use of the technique in making something physical has created an intellectual and emotional experience so that the medium of physical stuff of detail becomes, in practice, a venue for thinking and feeling.
One of the lines that stood out to me, and this goes back to the conversation about power having its effect on people and then people's response to that. Toward the end, there's this whole little piece about global capitalism that is from the point of view of somebody who is an investor and an investing amount of money that had sort of been sitting there for years, and the person who it belonged to kind of denied it or didn't want to have anything to do with it. And he says, "Wherever you find a landscape or a nation undergoing disturbance, there you will find the entrepreneur. The secret of management for capital growth isn't having a stomach for risk, but it's finding beauty in the destruction of obsolete systems and taking delight in the prospect of creating new ones." And that, like, I don't know why, but it jumped off the page at me because it was spoken in the voice of somebody who is looking at a systematic approach and fundamentally doesn't care about all the little individual lives that are affected by those changes, doesn't have any nostalgia for the past, and yet the first word in that sentence, one of the first words is landscape, so it is taking, like, an ecological metaphor approach to it that is really amoral in the same way that evolution in nature is amoral. And it really kind of summed up something in a very short space that to me was really big and profound. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Well, I mean, the character who says all of that is sort of the devil, but he's I think he's kind of funny. I mean, he's everything that you describe is in fact the effect of it on individual small people is quite awful, and he approaches it all from that from just the right distance that he could see it all clearly and take delight in it. And that is, in some ways, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's part of the spirit of capitalism. It hadn't occurred to me before to put it in these terms, but you know the famous adage that comedy is tragedy plus distance,
Right.
because the capitalist is basically employing an abstraction, employing capital, money, into a company that is itself producing the good or service. He is at a remove. So the character you're talking about is investing in these companies and enjoying the prospect of watching them grow and fail in the same way that, you watch a baseball game or, you do a chess match. You don't think, when the pawn is knocked over, you don't think a person has been killed. You just think, this is just an object on a grid.
Or when you see a prey animal get eaten by a carnivore.
Wait, say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, let's say you're watching, I just did an interview about beavers, and beavers are these industrious, wonderful little animals, and they're also, lunch for coyotes and wolves. And you could probably imagine getting attached to one of those things and then seeing it be eaten and getting really sad about it, but it's just, from a different perspective, it's just the way nature works. You can't get involved in that particular individual's life.
I just think that one of the great joys of writing a novel and reading a novel is that the novel, by its nature, brings you into intimacy with people who have mutually exclusive interests, so that you can simultaneously be in the point of view and sympathize with the coyote while you're also in the point of view and sympathizing with the beaver.
Right.
You can, at the moment when these when two characters who really matter to you, say, like the moment in Anna Karenina when Levin and Kitty are both in the same party at the same time, your mind just blows up because it's taken you hundreds of pages to build up the hugely intricate history and sympathy that you have with both of these people. And then you see the two of them, parallel lines are meeting. Like, how is this possible? Whenever you have that kind of impossible confluence, that's part of the joy of a novel. I say all that, like, I realize that part of what I'm sort of talking about is the wicked aspect of some of this is of course, that there are some people in the novel who are sufficiently removed from the consequences of their own cruelty that they will never feel it. Their conscience is not involved. And there are other people in the novel whose consciences are so refined that to fail to take responsibility even for a single sin, is just something that they just temperamentally, just as a matter of, not as a matter of principle, but as a matter of their own, their real makeup, they just can't do it. So I feel like having those kind of people in the same room with each other is, well, it's just interesting.
New Mexico plays a large role in this novel.
It does, yeah.
When you were at St. John's, but the New Mexico that we see is a very different New Mexico, especially further back in time and different parts of the state. What was the process of discovering that New Mexico?
Yeah, my attachment to New Mexico is via St. John's, of course. New Mexico was the first place I went after I left home. I mean, I drove away from Cleveland, Ohio when I was 18, and I drove into New Mexico, I think around noon or so. I remember I was in West Texas at sunrise with a friend of my brother's. And certain places imprint themselves on your being. I'd never seen the sunrise in Ohio or the sunset. The trees are too tall. And in New Mexico, seeing that happen is just a natural, totally normal daily occurrence. I believe in the imagination, and I have to say, I don't think a lot of the rest of our culture does very deeply. We speak of works of imagination as though they're fabrications. We say, fiction writers being modest, of course, say, I just made it up. And I obviously do a lot of research in terms of getting a lot of physical stuff right, but I also really believe that, well, there's a line in the book that speaks to this in some way. The imagination lived not in the center of a world of its own fancy, but at the edge of a world that was really there, a world of which it was a witnessing insignificant element. It required the imagination's eye to see what he really was. A man in a crowd of mountain, dust, road, water, naked and shivering while sweat poured down his back. My point is just that the state of New Mexico is an inspiration to my imagination, and some of the places that I describe are not places I've visited, or places I've only visited very briefly. Most of my time in New Mexico was in Santa Fe. But by definition, a fiction writer is making it all up in some way, even the parts that are much more intimate with her own experience.
It's so interesting to me that you say that because, the first sort of cliche thing when people are writing or, decide that they want to be writers is write what you know. And so I guess define the word know, the way you're using it and the way you're using this, the act of imagination is a different kind of knowing than what you've actually lived through yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's good practical advice, but part of what you discover when you're trying to write what you know is the limit of what you know and how quickly the story that you're telling and the truth of what you're trying to get to requires you to depart from your own experience.
Right. How long did you work on this book?
10 years.
So what was it like to live with the characters for all that time? Because, 10 years is a long time. You're a still fairly young man. How did they, or did these characters kind of evolve or change over the period that you were writing? Did you rewrite based on those changes?
Yeah, I shouldn't say this, but there, an earlier version of the first chapter was in the New Yorker about 8 or 9 years ago, and the volunteer of the title, he shows up under another name late in that story, and he's a different guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a fundamentally different guy. As I stayed with him throughout the book, and it became his book, I learned that he wasn't the person that I thought he was. He's, among other things, quieter, less sarcastic. I think he's more emotionally vulnerable than the person who is in that story. I don't, in general, take longer, take shorter rather than a year, even with a story, and I'm not really proud of that. But I do find that I can't really get close enough with a character to portray her life credibly, persuasively to myself, unless I've got actual lifetime involved with it. That is, number of hours of my actual Salvatore living in my body life. I can sometimes describe a character over, it could take me a year or two to describe a week and a half of a person's life, or it can take me that long to describe 40 or 50 years of that person's life. But my own time spent doing other things and occupying in my imagination that person's emotional responses to what she sees, it just takes a long time.
You, as we talked about, went to St. John's College here in Santa Fe. How do you feel that your time at St. John's contributed to your becoming a writer, if it did, and to this book in particular?
Oh, it's totally St. John's saved my life, really. I mean, I have no evidence that my current life would be possible had I not gone there. I mean, I was such a screw up in high school. I really had no, I wanted to read. I had read very little. I'd had a few searing experiences of reading up to that point, but I didn't really know how to read with any kind of care. I had no work habits. I had an idea of wanting to write, and I had written some, but I had not written very much. I think among the many things that can be said about St. John's, it is unique in the world that as I know it, in continuing to treat a book as a sacred object. I mean, the joke that was going around when I was there was that in most other places, if a person is caught in the rain with a book, they put the book over their head to protect their head. And at St. John's, they put the book under their shirt to protect the book.
Right.
And I had an experience there of being assigned to read things that I did not know how to be interested in, and learning to read them anyway, and learning that my capacity for taking pleasure was just much wider than I had ever, I had any way of knowing. I didn't know that Adam Smith was going to be so much fun. I mean, who knew? Thomas Aquinas still like haunts my brain. I mean, I didn't really know theology at all. I had read almost none of the Bible, being a Catholic. And, it really is the watershed time of my life. And of course, college is the watershed time for a lot of people's lives, but the program, there's a funny thing about the program. The program is very rigid, and it can seem from the outside as though it's a form that is trying to stamp a certain kind of learning onto a person's mind. And nothing could be further from the truth. The firmness and rigidity or clarity of the program is what allows just a tremendous freeing experience over years, because your mind is tangling with one kind of thing that's very far from your experience, and then another kind of thing that's very far from your experience. You're learning Greek, then you're learning Greek mathematics, and then you're learning Shakespeare, and then you're learning Thomas Aquinas, and all these things are so far away from your own little cage self that after not too long, it just stops being interesting to say, well, what I think, well, what I think, well, what I think. People don't do that at St. John's that much after they get to their sophomore year, because your opinions are not as interesting as your questions are.
Right.
So the sense of being freed really comes, it came in my experience from being freed from my own limited idea of who I was and what I was interested in.
What's next for you? I mean, you're going around the country, I guess, talking about the book, and you will be here in Santa Fe on Wednesday, March 27th at 7:30 at the Peterson Student Center up at St. John's. But what are you thinking about? Do you have to let a book like this kind of settle before you start a new one, or kind of where are you at creatively?
I did that with my first book, and it was a mistake. It was really, I had never finished a book before, and then I got to the end of that one, and I was kind of lost for a while. But no, I have another book that's about a third done already, and it's unlike other things. I sort of know I've written the beginning, I've written the end, I've written part of the middle, and I'm really eager to get to it. I really don't want to be taking time off in between, just because it's so lonesome when you're not, if writing is what you do every day, when you have these short periods when circumstances and travel really prevent you from being inside a novel, it can just feel like, you know, half your brain is asleep, and you know, physically, your physical health deteriorates. I have really no interest in exercise right now for some reason. The whole system sort of shuts down a little bit, and that's not good for me. So I've got another project.
Yeah. I have to say, it's so interesting to me that you would say that when you're not writing, you're lonesome, because the stuff that you're doing now is, at least from the outside, the much more kind of social and people-oriented part.
That's
of...
true, yeah.
Yeah.
That's true, but I mean, not to be too precious about this, but if you're writing a book for a long time, your intimacy with the characters is much more intense than your intimacy with people that you meet on the street or people that you talk to.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, a few times in your life. You don't miss those people when you leave them. And the worst part of writing a novel for me is that once the book is really done and out of my hands, like, I can just never talk to that person ever again.
I was wondering about that, because I have that experience as a reader, is, you know, I miss them when the book is done.
Yeah, it's like, on the one hand, that's like sort of sad, because we all should be having that kind of relationship with real people, right? On the other hand, I fail to find it unhealthy, I guess.
Well, I guess to me it demonstrates, you know, what it is, what it looks like when you have a calling, and that's your calling. So it's a beautiful thing.
Well, golly.
Salvatore Scibona is author of the new novel, The Volunteer. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
The Santa Fe New Mexican is hiring. Immediate spots are open in the company's production department, and eagle-eyed listeners with a keen sense of style, wit, and diligence can learn more about copy editing positions at Pasatiempo. Visit sfnm.co/TNM_careers for more information. We'll also include the link on today's podcast at radiocafe.org. The Santa Fe New Mexican is an equal opportunity employer. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.